So first of all, that January, and we think of January as New Year's resolutions and all, but January it's been traditionally in a number of societies, cultures, to be a time of change, because the winter is when things lie fallow, and then there's going to be a new spring, but we've got time to knit our clothes or make new clothes or tell our stories and imagine new possibilities when we can move out of the caves and back onto the savannah or wherever it may be. And so this the Roman god Janus is pictured as this standing in the doorway, in the threshold, both not in the building, but not outside it either, but an in-between space. And the god is pictured as having a face looking backwards and a face looking forward. So looking at the past as well as the future, but not being in the past, nor yet being in the future. And I'd like to remind us of that, because there is possibility of opening to change on a much more profound level than the usual resolutions we make. That we can say that in this coming year, there's this one aspect that I'm going to really be dramatically different in. It can be taking a characteristic and exploring that characteristic, a quality of a character, but I mean that characteristic. It can be a Dharma understanding. It can be one person that you're going to really change your relationship with in a way that is not contention on their agreeing to change their relationship with you, that you claim for yourself. It can be something about your own behavior in a more profound way than, oh, I'm going to lose some weight, or I'm going to go to the gym. Nothing wrong with the lose the weight, going to the gym, all of that at all. But there's larger possibilities, because this is a time when we can pause and let something sit in us for a while. We don't have to immediately change, but we can contemplate change for a period of time. So, first thing. Coming out of that is imagining one's year. And again, on when I teach in the Sunday evenings, when I come to teach, and when I was here every week for years, we're interested in the Dharma in daily life, how we show up in our daily lives using the wisdom that comes from the Buddha, from Buddhist psychology, from a Buddhist approach to daily life, to inform our life in a way that makes our life richer and more effective. And so coming out of this sense that this is a new year, I'm going to do three categories of suggestions for you to think about. The first is cultivating clarity. At the beginning of the meditation tonight, and more often I do this, about clarity of purpose and clarity of intention. Clarity of purpose is clarity of your aspiration or goals. But I treat those two as slightly different. But clarity of purpose, and then clarity of intention. And intention is the here and now. In this very moment, what's my intention? Whatever goal I'm moving towards, how do I intend, based on my values, to meet this moment towards my goal? Which is different than the clarity of purpose, that's more goal-oriented, more right view of the Eightfold Path, whereas intention is the second of the parts of the Eightfold Path, second fold of the Eightfold Path. And then clarity of values, clarity of choice. So we use mindfulness and reflection and inquiry for clarity of purpose, intention, clarity of our values, and clarity of choice. I do Dharma talks and each of those things as a singular thing, but now just taking here for a moment, any question about what I mean by clarity, or what I mean by clarity of purpose or intention or values or choice. And I said during the Dharma talk that this that our choice of what? Choice to choose non-suffering over suffering. From a Dharma perspective, we're here and as a Dharma community, knowing the truth, using our higher nature, we're getting in touch with our higher possibilities. And that higher possibility is to choose non-suffering over suffering for ourselves and how we treat others and how we interact with others that allow others to cause suffering to us. So sometimes that's the big change, is that I will not be in this relationship with my sibling in the way I have been for the last 15 years or 40 years, in which it's causes so much suffering. She may not change, but I will change, just as an example. Non-romantic relationship, to make it easier. So anyone have any question about this? I'm not trying to encourage one, but I'm really wanting to make sure that. Okay? So that's the first suggestion in terms of how you might work with this idea of being at a threshold, cultivating clarity within yourself. And the clarity that I have chosen is the clarity that would be within the Buddhist framework at looking at change. And then the second of these suggestions that you might work with yourself during these next few months towards bringing about movement within you and the year is to mindfully meet the moment. To make this commitment that, you know, over and over again, whatever I'm doing all day long, I'm going to bring mindfulness into meeting this moment of here and now. So I may not be doing very well, but I'll be mindful of not doing very well. And in time, that will change how we do. Because the mindfulness over and over again has a purification process, and it also, we just can't stand it anymore after a period of time. I just can't stand to be mindful of this anymore. And if I'm going to be mindful, then I'm going to stop doing it. I just can't stand it anymore. It's just too irritating or too boring or too whatever. And we just change somehow. Rather than thinking, oh, I've got to change. I've got to stop being so angry. We're mindful over and over again. And I'll give instructions as how to be with it in the moment. But this commitment that I'm going to meet every moment. And I'm going to cultivate. I'm going to bring in this mindful moment certain qualities of mind and heart. And one of those that I, for this last year or two, have been utilizing so much with people is being mindful in a way that's compassionate. So before you even know what's happening, you've already got this attitude, this mental heart quality of compassion. So then you discover you're bored, and you go, well, should I really be having compassion for boredom? If, in fact, it's causing you harm, if it's causing suffering, if boredom leads you to get yourself in trouble, to open the refrigerator door, to turn on the Netflix, whatever it is, in a way that's harmful, yes, it's causing you harmful, being bored. But also sometimes we occupy our mind with unsettling memories to avoid being bored because we want to be entertained. Or some old story comes up in the empty spaces. And so compassion, we assume a compassionate form of meeting the moment. So otherwise, when that person cuts us off, we go to anger. You know, when we're driving and they cut us off and could easily have hit us, we go to anger because we don't already have a momentum towards compassion. And then that leads to all sorts of things, as we know. And that can be anger over someone in a meeting, someone at home, during a social situation. So, cultivation of compassion. And then the one that's maybe more surprising that I've found to be so useful because I practice it for myself and have for so long, so many years, is this attitude of amusement. And so there's a kind of, you could call it bemused if you like, but amused at the human situation. You you know, here I'm doing it again, you know, or, wow, trying to work all this out is so confusing. It's really hard being a human being. I think everyone in here is old enough to have noticed that by now. It's hard. This is very hard. Embodied awareness that is reflective in nature and aware of its own reflection is a very difficult way to live. It's hard. And you may go, oh, I don't really think all that. Then you can just think of your difficulties and see how many of the difficulties come from the fact that you're aware of your experience and you comment on your experience, or you comment on other people's experience, or you want the experience to be different in a way that other sentient beings in our planet, at least, don't seem to have that same range of awareness that we have. So that amusement, and the amusement is not making fun of, but wow, you know, just it's too serious to be serious about all the time. I was in a guidance situation with someone a couple of weeks ago, and I gave this advice to this person about, because they really take their work, their job, very seriously. I mean, they are really serious all the time. And I was given this advice about compassion and about amusement. And the person said to me, you know, Philip, I've been around you enough to know that you may be the most serious person that I actually know personally. And so I sort of nodded with that. That's their view one way or the other. I didn't have to have a view about that myself. And they said, but I have seen that you, in fact, do have this amusement. You laugh a lot. You have a smile on your face. You can talk about the difficulty and be smiling. You can go into a group of people, and they're all mad, and some of them mad at you, and you're still smiling and all this. And so the person said, so I actually, having seen one person do this, I have faith that it's possible, but I'm just not sure it's possible for me. And that's very understandable. But I had that, when I really set about to cultivate this attitude, I was somewhat doubtful that I could handle it, because I have so much fixing attitude in my nature that, you know, I don't have time to, like, be amused and see the irony of it and the play of the opposites that's going on in life, because I'm too busy, got to get on to fixing it. And gradually, over many, many years, this has really changed. It arises more and more spontaneous in me. And a great example of this, of course, is my teacher, Ajahn Sumedho. He is a wonderful example of having this amusement. He's got a major health problem right now with his eyes. And in his reporting of that, he just can't see. He's losing his sight, but he sees the lightness of it, not just the darkness, not just the oh woe is me, but has an amused thing about, you know, we gain and we lose, and you know, it just the Nietzsche and all of that. Nietzsche is not dreadful. There, it's even when it's not going our way. That's that truth of a Nietzsche, that the ever-changing nature of things. You can't beat it, so you smile at it. Do you have a feel for what I mean by this?
Yes.
It's so important a thing for well-being, at least in my experience. And then the third quality that I'm mentioning under this, how to meet the moment, every moment to be committed to meeting the moment, to being in the moment, is that of curiosity. And the awakening factors, it's referred to as investigation. But investigation can have a lot of doing in it. And if we're not really in practice mode, it can get rigid and pushing and pulling at things in a certain way. Whereas curiosity is like, oh, well, this is a fine mess. I wonder what's going to happen next. And that's very different. So I've had a number of health challenges in these last almost 3 years now. And I mean, that's just a couple weeks from 3 years. And this has been such a help to me. I'm just curious as to what's going to happen next, or how's this going to turn out, as opposed to like getting all uptight about wanting to regain my health, or to not have it, seeing all the challenges. Like tonight I could do the movement exercise with my right arm somewhat, and for a long time I couldn't do the exercise with my right arm, and I've had trouble with breath now for almost 3 years, and I just got a new diagnosis the other day. I've had all these different diagnoses, and my breath has recovered. It's like 75% now of normal, and I'm curious, will it get more, or will it stay the same? Is it going to deteriorate? I don't know, and I can't know, and if any of the experts knew, they would have told me by now, because I've been to enough of them. So I've kind of abandoned that approach to knowing. So I'm just curious. So it's not that I need a certain outcome, and yet I can care. And this is a very sweet spot for human beings. And we are all capable of this. We can care, but not be clutching to the caring. We're curious. We have a clear preference, and there's nothing wrong with having the preference, but demanding preferences be met, how has that worked for you thus far? So there's this compassion with a degree of amusement, and then with this curiosity, it allows a buoyancy, it allows a kind of absorptive and response quality to meeting the moment. So we don't get stuck in the mud of the moment, even though there may be mud there. You know, there may be swampy, and yet we don't. There's a lightness that stops that heaviness from sinking us down. But it doesn't mean there won't be heavy moments. There's been a lot of heavy moments in this last year of my life in a lot of different ways. But this has held true. And so why does this meeting the moment, why is that so important? Because it's the moment of your life that you're present for. If you're not present for this moment, you're kind of missing your life. Because you're not here in the before, right? You're here in this moment. What happened before? What happened, you know, in meditation when you're driving here? You can't be present in those moments. They're gone. So you can't affect them. Because they're gone. So you can't redo them. And the moment when you leave here, when you drive away, when you're on home the next morning, you're not here for that moment. You're not here. New version of you will be here for that moment, those moments. So you can't affect that moment. You just can't. Mindfulness, the being present through mindfulness in this here and now, gives us a chance to have choice to affect, based on our values, if you're taking this approach, the Buddha, the Eightfold Path, that to affect how you are towards yourself, how you are towards others, how you are towards your environment, and how others and your environment are affecting you. That's a huge gift, a huge benefit of choosing to be present moment to moment. And that means that there's a wisdom by being present in the moment. And however well we do or don't do is equally valuable to gaining wisdom. So times when we are just, oh, gosh, I can't believe I said that. Oh, I can't believe I agreed to that. Oh, if we're being present for it in the Dharma sense, in insight, then we learn. And so we're cultivating wisdom. And the more that we have this compassion and this kind of gentle amusement and this kind of curiosity, the more wisdom will be cultivated, because we don't get caught in this circle of our story over and over again as often or as intense as for as long a duration. Otherwise, we're just in our circle pattern, you know, of repeating ourselves. And so that gives us then choice. Choice requires we be here. We have to be in the moment to have choice. And we're developing qualities, a way of relating to the moment that gives us this. So this is a way to meet a new year. And then finally, in terms of things that you, and I'm not expecting you to remember all of this, I'm just stimulating, maybe one of these will you go, yeah, I'm going to retain that and explore that more. The third is the shift in the way that we are actually conscious, so that we are when we're looking for clarity, when we're moving into the moment, seeking that clarity, we have this shift in consciousness, so that when whatever's happening, we move from being so identified with it. Oh, you know, I can't believe this person said this to me, or oh, my back hurts, or whatever it is, or oh, I'm so excited, oh, if I can only get this, or only if my child only gets this, then the world's going to be perfect. Whatever those feelings were, we're so identified that we're clinging, that our sense of choice is lost in our wanting or our aversion, that we shift from that to what I call this participant observer identity. So it, rather than identifying with the experiences, the pleasant and unpleasant, the wanting, the not wanting, we are going, okay, this is what this life is, and this stream of experience, this stream of consciousness. And I'm both a participant and I'm an observer. And so there's space around it. We're not enclosed in it in the same way. And in the long run, if we find, again, the sweet spot of that, we feel more alive, not less alive. We're not, that participant observer is not this distant observer. It's, you're in the middle of it. You're feeling what it feels like to feel love, or to feel gratitude, or to feel anger, or whatever it may be. You're in the middle of it, but you're not identified with it. But in, if you're not so identified, you get a deeper, a wider, a larger, a more holistic experience from that. In, at least that has been the way I have known it. And so the shift in consciousness, first to the participant observer, and then likewise moving from being reactive mind state to responsive. So you, instead of just reacting, you're responding. Responding in what way? From your values, rather than whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. That is a lot of freedom. So this person is pushing your buttons, or your buttons have already pushed, and this poor person entered into your field, and there you are. And you just react from your, you were in a bad mood, or you're interpreting the world's against you, whatever it is. Instead of reacting from whatever the conditions are of your mind, and of the larger conditions, you respond from your values. So you may feel yucky and irritable, but you're kind to the person in front of you, because it's a value to be kind. And you have choice, because of these practices have actually given you choice. In a very real way, none of this is theoretical at all. Very real, to be observed in daily life, not reserved for a retreat or anything. And then we start to realize that we, in fact, can have a huge amount of freedom from the tyranny of pleasant and unpleasant, and how it usually rules our experience, our interpretation of events. If it's pleasant, we interpret it one way, and we go into kind of grasping. If it's unpleasant, we react in another way, and we start to have pleasant and unpleasant, and our old habits of mind, the way we've been conditioned, be just things that are arising but not defining us. So this is if you're interested in having resolution, which is a parami, being resolve, having resolve, and this new year, this is a Buddhist approach to it, much more this way. And you don't take all of these at once. You just take one little piece of it and start to work with it. And if you go, oh well, maybe I'll think about that, but oh, I don't have it. I don't have notes on this and all. The talk is posted, right? Mm-hmm. So you can listen to the talk again, at least the piece of it that you're interested in. Skip the rest. Mm-hmm. And speaking of rest, in terms of resolutions, in terms of beginning a new year, this idea that I will treat myself as though I'm worthy of receiving rest. That I won't let others demand of me in such a way that I don't get rest. That I won't demand of myself in ways that I don't get rest. That I treat myself as being worthy of rest. That I would have a spaciousness of mind, an energetic in the body, an ease in the heart, where it would be appropriate to say, yeah, I'm tired, but my body's pretty restful. My body is, it's tired, but it's not. There's still a rest feeling. Or at the beginning of the day, there's a rest in my body, if that's more imaginable for you. And the same thing, that this is a difficult time, heart-wise, but my heart's at rest in this difficult time. Or I have a lot to do, and I have a lot of decisions to make, and some of these decisions, there's no pleasant alternative. But my mind's at ease. My mind's at ease. So this is what I mean by rest. I'm going to cover this in many different ways. And so in Dharma practice, there's literally letting yourself be resting at the beginning of a retreat, or letting yourself, when you sit down to do your daily practice, give yourself a few minutes of just resting. So you're just being there, letting your mind rest, catching up with yourself, like remembering what you're about, the way I took us through about clarity of purpose and clarity of intention. That can really rest the mind, which is all geared up for its day, or geared up in tension from having the day. So letting the mind know relaxation. And then in practice, of our practice, when we're, attention, as I said in the meditation, is like the spotlight. That is spotlight on something. And we learn to rest that spotlight. We rest attention without it having to be tense. So there does not have to be tension in attention. So hold out your left hand. Put your right hand above it. And then notice that if you're holding the right hand, it just occasionally touches it. There's a lot of tension in holding this hand in this way. Now, push with your right hand, push into your left hand. That you can feel is tension, right? Now squeeze it. That's tension. Pull it, push it. Tension, right? Shake all that out. And now, left hand back up, and just rest your right hand in it. That's what I mean by resting. That's the felt sense of resting. So when we're practicing, when our attention can rest on the body, just as the body can rest on earth, we can rest our attention and have that same felt sense. It feels good. It's not tense to be paying attention automatically. It can be just that way. And likewise, when we're resting attention on the breath, it can be as easeful as resting on the body. The body's easier in some way because there's more of a stillness in the body. But even in the movement of the one breath is moving, it's going in, it's going out, there's maybe a little pause between breaths, but it's possible to rest in the experience of breath, that the mind does not have to be in a tense form. When we teach the concentration retreat every year at Spirit Rock, this is one of the chief instructions, is to develop relaxed attention that allows you to soften into the experience. Relaxed attention allows you to soften in. The reason is if your attention is tight, it bounces off the experience. It doesn't soften into, it gets less information because it's so tight. this is just energy dynamics true. That's not a theory or a philosophy. It's just the way energy works. It bounces off. It doesn't have time to pick up the subtlety of the moment in that way. And so we're learning to rest attention in this way. And then the fruit comes in with the difficult mind states and the difficult experiences of our life. We're able to stay with these difficult experiences of our life. We're able to be with difficult mind states in a way where the mind is at ease. It's rested. It's resting in the experience. Wouldn't be our preference, but this is the experience we have. And so the mind does not become tight and clingy and graspy and self-recriminating or blaming. It's just, it's at rest. It's, even though it's difficult, we can be at ease with unease. You, just as you are now, not a new improved version of yourself, but you as you are now. So rest as a verb, the two most common meanings I found in the dictionary is to ease of ease in work or movement. So the mind is always moving. And so when there's rest, there's ease of movement. There's less movement, but what movement there's more ease. So it's both ways. We think of, okay, I'm resting. The mind's resting right now. It's not moving at all. And that's the A part. But the B part is that, yes, the mind's moving, but there's a kind of rested feeling. There's a spaciousness to it. The mind's at rest as it's moving. So you're worrying about something, you know, like, should I do this or should I do that? What's going to happen? And yet there can be a feeling of rest even in this movement. Literally, again, not theoretically. And so this is this first meaning. And then the second meaning that's so common is to be placed or supported by, as so to stay in a specific position. So the mind's resting, it's staying in stillness, it's staying in the same position. And this is where mindfulness is so empowering, is that that mindfulness creates a kind of stillness. It stays with experience in a non-reactive way. And just being mindful over and over again, you're developing this capacity, like you're working out in the gym and developing muscle, or learning to move energy in a certain way. It's just the same. It's just the same. The mind, when it's at rest, can be placed or supported so it stays in a specific position. You're staying with mindfulness. The mind's moving everywhere, and the mindfulness just moves with it. Just the way those hips were turning in the movement practice, it just stays with it. This is called choiceless awareness, and choiceless awareness meditation, if it's meditation, but choiceless awareness in daily life. So you're thinking about this, you're thinking about that, and the mindfulness just goes with it. It doesn't need you to be doing something specific. It can let you go wherever if the mind's going for whatever reason. And this attention stays with it. This attention that is filled with compassion and a degree of amusement and with this curiosity. So you're not at war with yourself. You're not fighting yourself. And gradually, because there is this degree of wholeness, this degree towards balance that happens, gradually things start to right themselves within us. Now, more and more, we start to have choice. The more mindfulness and the more insight we've had, the more we've had choice. We have choice, and the more we have confidence in that. As we have more confidence, it's easier to rest. So our practice brings fruits that's empowering. But the faith is the faith to try to give ourselves a chance to meet life this way. Otherwise, we are each going to be forever in our soap opera. And the soap opera is interesting at times, but boy, do we pay a high price for that soap opera. You know, will she choose me? Will he choose me or not? oh, was this the right marriage to be in? Should I stay in this marriage? Oh, this is just on and on and on. All of this endless living the soap opera, you know, including at the national level, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. The soap opera, we're living such a soap opera at present. No matter how you feel about it, the form it's taken, even if you happen to have those values, it's still a soap opera. And if it's not your values, it's an agonizing soap opera. But either way, it's a soap opera. And so we can go up and down constantly with that, or we can say, this too is part of life. This too. And we have compassion for the suffering that life is like this. We have a degree of amusement. Nobody would believe this. You couldn't do a TV show version of this because nobody would believe it. That's amusing, right? And then the curiosity, like, well, but who do I want to be in relation to all this? Who do I want to be? That kind of curiosity, not so much a passion all the time, but this more times of passion in this field of curiosity. So rest does have a felt sense, as I was showing you with the hand, and that's if you're going to know rest, then you want to be very awake to when you feel rest, when you feel rested when you wake up. For the last 3 years, well, not this last 6 months or so, but for two of the last 3 years, I would wake up having slept a number of hours, but I never felt rested except maybe twice a month, but maybe once a month, I would wake up feeling rested. And I knew, because I'm mindful of what feeling rested is, I really knew what rested is. This was mine to carry. But the fact that I knew I wasn't rested gave me so much information, and not getting tight about it allowed me to deal with a difficult situation with more ease towards myself and also less burden to others in various forms. This is understanding this felt sense of rest. You may feel you may have a felt sense of the body being at rest, but you may not know so much about your mind being at rest. Why would you have thought of it unless you were tormented? And maybe you know when your mind's not tormented, but you don't know when it's really at ease. So if it's extreme, you know, but like little moments. So like if your mind is already in a tangle, would you choose to do something that would get your mind in more of a tangle? Is that going to bring a mind that's at rest? Not likely. And so you choose something, you go, well, this got it all tangled more. That's clearly not the way to move towards having a mind at rest. And so we learn to be in relationship. I wish my mind to be at rest, to be at ease, to have a kind of stillness that feels supported in this way. And then the same with the heart, learning to rest our heart, to create the conditions where our heart can heal, where it can be at rest, that even though it's a difficult time, even though something untoward has just happened to me or someone I deeply care for, still there's room for my heart to be at rest, to at least have moments of rest. How do we do that? Maybe for you it's going out into nature. Maybe for you it's getting on a dance floor. Or maybe for you it's reading poetry or talking with a friend over tea. But something that rests the heart, and we know our heart, we're mindful of our heart, just as we're mindful of the body, just as we're mindful of the head center, and we know our mindfulness, and with this sense of clarity of purpose and intention and all, it all ties together, you see. So you start to be dancing with life. You've got a approach, you've got a whole picture that is mutually supportive of how you can dance with life, how you can find more of a sense of rest, of ease in your life. And again, this is not based on the conditions. You practice with whatever conditions are present. That's the beauty of the Dhamma, It's not based on getting all the conditions right. It's based on cultivating how you're relating to the conditions that are present. That's why it works so much better than anything else I've found in that way, in terms of a life unfolding. So, as we look at this more and more, we can start to see that we spend so much of our time doing. So, can we have moments of non-doing? And are moments of non-doing restful for you? Or because you're so addicted to doing that it's actually not initially restful at all? Because you're too agitated, you feel like you should be doing something. Or you may not have a thought of that, but it's already in the impulse. I got to do something else. So do you ever come home from work and just sit there? Just sit there. That's resting. And it's not supposed to be like a certain way. You're just resting. It's going to be however it is. But it allows you, if nothing else, to catch up with yourself. And that's so useful when we catch up with ourselves. And you may think, I'm always up with myself. That, I can guarantee, is not true. I can guarantee that. It's a whole effort to catch up with yourself. And giving these little respites is one way to at least some parts of you to catch up with yourself. It's just, we live in such an overstimulated world that it's just impossible to catch up with ourselves in real time all the time. Maybe the Dalai Lama or Ajahn Sumedho or something, but the rest of us. So we notice doing and non-doing. Non-doing maybe evolves into a feeling of just being. Just being, where we're not even like, you can sit and not be meditating. You're just being. We often do that on Sunday evenings for just a moment or two. And so that's part of this resting. And then there's a phrase that is... I've heard more and more in the last couple of years with where people are talking about their mindfulness. And as you know, mindfulness has become so popular that everybody's talking about mindfulness with little or no instruction oftentimes. And then I will be present in a group when people say, oh, well, what I'm doing in that situation is I'm just resting in awareness. Maybe one out of 500 times or something like that, that might be true. Resting in awareness is a very hard thing to do. And it would require, first of all, that you have some sense of what that means to have an intention to rest in awareness. You can be resting back and being mindful of the experience. So, you know, something's going on. You're at work where there's a lot of tension, or in your family life and there's a lot of attention, and so you're at Christmas dinner or something, and rather than get caught in it, you're just being mindful, whoa, there's a lot of tension here, this is where I get caught a lot. You're resting back into mindfulness. That is possible. That is possible. Likewise, you can rest back and, oh, there's knowing. So knee pain is like this, or feeling insecure is feeling like this. There's knowing you know there's this knowing. You're resting in knowing that something is happening rather than so identified with it. You're resting. It's not the same as mindfulness exactly. It's a different quality. It's the knowing. It's the phenomena of consciousness. You're aware of it. That I am conscious of knee pain. I'm consciousness of being embarrassed. I'm consciousness of this. Is this talk useful to anyone? It's there's a that you're conscious of what's being known, and you're aware of that phenomena, that there's consciousness, that we have, as I mentioned earlier, we as a species have this ability to not just be having a consciousness as a stimulant, that we're conscious of the stimulant, we're conscious of that we know we're having this stimulant. So, I'm too hot, that's a stimulant. That's an object arising. Oh, too hot, too cold. It's a stimulant arising in the mind. We know we're too hot or too cold, but we also know that we know we're too hot or too cold. So we can be rest back in the knowing of it, that's resting back so that we're getting more observer and less participant feeling. That people can do. That's not that easy. But you can cultivate that more and more. Resting back in awareness itself is something that I would not start out with as even that big of an interest. I would start much more with the mindfulness and then this consciousness. That's what I would do in terms of learning how to be at rest in this way. I'm not even going to try to describe that. And the last thing that I want to do here, I think, moment to moment in our lives, and there's a couple people in here, I want to really hear this. Rest can be like in music. So you can think of, you know, ordinarily we think of this stream of experience, the stream of mind moments. You can also think of your life as like this ongoing stream of music. And you can start to feel the rest in between the notes. That you can feel, in Buddhist psychology, it's the Bhavanga mind. There's these moments. In Buddhist psychology, we have these rest between mind moments. And there, I say there because I didn't create it, but in that description of the mind, there are these moments. But whether you don't have to, I only mention that to root this in the tradition, but you can feel the rest. You can, if you get interested in this, this is not easy, but it's fun to explore. Well, there is, because there's rest. There's these little pauses of non-doing between any doing. There's just these little pauses that you can find there. And it just, oh, I want to feel that moment, those interstitial moments. I've called them for decades before I ever knew about Bhavanga mind or any of that. These little interstitial moments when nothing is going on. And things can be going that fast. And still there's these little... If you just invite the knowing of that, you act as though you can access it. You can just see what happens. Or you can hold it as an aspiration. Yeah, I don't want... And music, if without the rest, you know, music would not be very pleasant, right? That sense of seeing it as music in that way. You can also feel rest as resting in the Buddha, resting in the Dhamma, and resting in the Sangha. So when we feel overwhelmed, we can rest in these larger understandings that are more impersonal than personal. I've told the story in here of being on a retreat with a Sadhguru who was very insistent on keeping one-pointedness for an hour. And as a beginning, that was your beginning of practice. You couldn't really begin until you could keep one-pointedness for an hour. And how I found to do that, because that's not my style of practice at all, was I would rest in the Buddha or the Dhamma or the Sangha or all three. And that resting back in that where I wasn't, there wasn't a me carrying it. Mm-hmm. It was the Buddha and the Dhamma was carrying it. So many times in our life, we can go, I'm overwhelmed, but I can rest back in knowing that truth can carry this, that Buddha nature can carry it, however you want to describe that to yourself. resting in the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, taking refuge in that, resting in Buddha nature, resting in don't know mind. I don't know what to do here. But I do know that I don't know. That's the one thing I know. That is my one ground, is that I don't know. Because in every other way, I'm overwhelmed. But I do know that I don't know. That is resting in Dhamma. So, it's a little more complicated to explain, but you can also rest in the truth of the three characteristics of that there is dukkha, there is this stress, unease, unsatisfactoriness. The knowing of that can be restful because it makes it impersonal. It's just the big truth of life rather than, oh, I must be so unworthy to have dukkha in my life. No, there is dukkha. There is dukkha. And there is anicca. There is change. And so this change is happening to me. I don't want this change to happen. It's not about what you want. It's not about you having done something wrong. Change is part of the deal of being a human being, living in this realm. And the same is this not-self of this, which I won't try to explain tonight. But you can rest in those three characteristics in that way. And you can rest in your own feelings of love, even if at this moment it's only a memory. That you have love for life, or you have love for humanity. It can be. It doesn't have to be a kind of romantic feeling of love at all. It doesn't have to be. It doesn't even have to be the love of interpersonal, that you love people. Just this feeling of love, whatever form it can take. If you get interested in exploring this idea, you will discover that this kind of love that, again, lots of different forms of it, but our manifestations would be a better word. We can rest in love. We can rest in our caring. I am helpless to do, but I still have the choice to care. This is not what I would have chosen at all. But I don't have to abandon it. I can still care. This feeling of support, of at ease, of a stillness, of a constancy, a steadiness, resting in love. And there can be an aspirational aspect to this, that I'm resting in. I'm resting, and I aspire to rest in love as best I'm able in this moment. And you may not produce much, but the inclining of the heart in this way is the power. And it really, again, genuinely works. We learn to incline, and through the inclining, this very gentle inclining, there arises at some point the manifestation. Again, within my experience of people in this way. So this concludes my remarks on this idea of resting, and encouraging you to consider that this would be one of the things you might want to explore about your relationship to rest in your life, all the different manifestations, subtleties of it, resting mind, heart, body, resting. Sometimes what you could do in friendship is that you're there with your friends and they're talking a lot, but you're actually just resting in companionship. And so your need to sort of get in your experience can lessen because you like the camaraderie. You like, I care about these people. And that's more satisfying than getting to share your experience once we get over this, you know, so much reference that, oh, I want to share mine too. Nothing wrong with sharing our experience, but we get a lot more benefit if we can also just rest in the care. I'm not going to take any questions with this at this point, but just stay here with it for a moment. And now let's go into a kind of we got a ceremony that we're going to be doing later, so we're going to end here a few minutes early. So let's let this resting arise as we close our eyes. And just rest. Don't try to figure out what's happening. Just be available to the felt sense of rest. I repeat and request, suggest, just rest. Third time, just rest. Now rest your heart. Just invite it to rest in this warm, caring environment. Felt sense. Just rest, heart.